League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Muddy Knees Media.
Totally Football Show European Edition today. Champions League, cash converter, what the Man City verdict means for the citizens and football. Plus, we break down the draw for this season's knockout stages. There's also the weekend's game, Serie A, Atalanta the Enchanter, and scientist-fied perfect specimen of Goran Pandev preserved in amber, and Liga, where Espanyol couldn't manage to stay up, and neither could Gareth Bale. Plus, we catch up with a mess in MLS in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hello, listener, and hello to our Euro panel, Raphael Honigstein.
Hello, James.
James Horncastle.
Good day to you.
Alvaro Romeo.
How are you, James?
Very well, thank you. And Julien Laurence.
Hi, James.
Lovely to see you all. Jules, listen, we ought to start with this shock news about Serge Aurier's brother. Christopher, have you got any of the background details on this story?
Yeah, terrible news for Serge and for the Aurier family. His younger brother, Christopher, who was 26, who lived in Toulouse in southwest of France. He was playing amateur football there, got shot dead very early this morning around 5 a.m., the police said, outside a nightclub, or at least not far from a nightclub, two gunshot in the abdomen, and he couldn't be saved once he got to the hospital. It's terrible, really terrible stories. He was very close to Serge. They were together at the Lens Academy when they were younger. He didn't make it as a pro, but was he playing at a good level, fifth division in France, so semi-pro, but could not really, make it to his dream like his brother. So it's terrible news. And the killer or the potential killer has fled as well. So there's a big investigation going on right now in Toulouse to try to find the one or two or more people, and the police are looking for witnesses as well, or people who would know something, maybe in the nightclub where apparently Christopher went that night on Sunday, between Sunday and Monday night. So yes, terrible news for the Aurier family.
There's no idea yet as to why this might have happened.
No, I mean, the only thing is the local newspaper, La Dépêche du Midi, there in Toulouse, said that Christopher had some previous issue with the police and stuff that he did. And that's all we know about maybe why that could have happened. It looks, again, that he spent some of the night in that nightclub, not far from me, in the west suburbs of the city. And then, I don't know, maybe there was an argument over there. I mean, we can all speculate, but clearly they came out of the nightclub and then ended up in that argument on a like industrial estate not far from there where the shotgun were shot at Christopher. But I think the from what the police said, the investigation could be quite quick because there was obviously a lot of people who saw Christopher before he died in that nightclub, and like I said, he was quite well known from the police over there.
Terribly sad news for the Aurier family. After this, we'll move on to the weekend's football.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show with James Richardson, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. And if you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, make sure you check out their coverage of each and every Premier League club by taking out a free 30-day trial by heading to theathletic.com/totally.
All right, big week in the Champions League and for UEFA in general. What with the draw for the Europa and Champions Leagues held last week, and this Monday morning, the verdict in Man City's appeal against their two-season Champions League ban. That's been waived, and instead they've been hit with a fine reduced from 30 million to just 10 million euros, which, given they'll make, I think, 15 million euros just from participating in next year's group stage anyway, isn't too much of a penalty. What does it all mean? Well, here's Raphael Honigstein in a bubble bath to explain.
Well, first of all, it means that City are back in the Champions League, as you just said. I think that is the most important part of this verdict today. what it means beyond that for FFP, for UEFA, we really have to wait and see a little bit longer. I think it's a natural reaction, perhaps a bit of a knee-jerk one to say FFP is now dead. But as Kaz explained in their verdict, the reason why City were let off effectively is because most of the alleged breaches have been time-barred, i.e. UEFA just didn't manage to investigate in time before the 5-year statutory limitations run out, and that other parts of the allegations were simply not proven. Again, we have to wait, I think, a little bit longer to understand what that really means. Certainly City, I think, have throughout this process been very, very confident, saying that they have irrefutable evidence why this ban should be overturned. And in the end, you have to say, on the face of it, CAS have agreed with them. So, you know, whether that means that UEFA just got their own process wrong or simply didn't have enough evidence to back up the allegations that came from the Football League's emails, we have to wait and see. But I'd caution against this idea that FFP is now dead and completely meaningless because of this case.
Listener N are writing in saying, how do you think fans feel after seeing their club selling off their best players time and time again to get in with financial fair play, only to see this verdict today? Do you guys share Rafa's view that this isn't a mortal blow to the financial fair play regulations?
I think in public perception, it is. I think we'll have to see what the published ruling will be, what the detail behind this is as a justification. But you know, I spoke to one executive of a European club today, and they felt that reform of FFP is necessary and in some respects inevitable. And they feel that it's already started because the issue has been forced by COVID-19 and the pandemic for new provisions to be made. And I think in conjunction with this story as well, it might force the issue even more. But we'll have to see, I think.
But in which way, James? Because coronavirus now has basically led to a loosening of regulations, but at the same time, people want tougher regulations to avoid the next Manchester City.
I suspect that it would be in the direction of looser regulations. Even though UEFA have, over the last few years, have made a big song and dance out of how prior to FFP, European football clubs were making a loss of, what, 1.67 billion. And in the last 2 years, the European game has been profitable. And that is seen as the success of financial fair play, even though we know that the game has never been more polarized in that time. How the rich have got richer, and leagues have become less competitive and more stratified than ever. So I think in some respects, a conversation needs to be had about incorporating some of the best bits of FFP, but I think loosening it up a little bit. I know we've seen this for clubs that have been taken over in some of Europe's top five leagues, where because of the problems that they've inherited, they just haven't been able to make the most of the project that they've got, you know, particularly in countries like Italy, where, you know, if you don't own a stadium where you can make money, you're limited in the amount of money that you can earn, and therefore then invest in your club and make it more competitive, which is an issue.
In terms of the ramifications for people respecting FFP or not, it's also worth just stressing the fact that, as Rafa mentioned, the reason that Man City were able to get the ban overturned was that it was outside the 5-year window for these alleged offences, and that was because the leaks hadn't even happened until 2018. A lot of the offences were dating back to 2012. So in that respect,
alleged offences
were dating back to 2012. So in that sense, it's not rewriting FFP regulations, just saying that they can't apply because the time had passed.
It's just the investigation perhaps came too late, or the court case came a little bit too late. But happens a lot in justice as well, that sometimes you may feel that something is not right. But the time bar thing is something that happens a lot in sports cases as well. And when, for example, judging some doping scandals retrospectively as well. So I think that this is something that perhaps we know that there are alleged evidences, but definitely insufficient conclusive evidences, and this didn't make a case for Manchester City to miss the next Champions League campaign.
Jules, is this going to make clubs respect FFP less?
I mean, let's not forget that Man City got done for FFP in 2014. So they agreed a settlement with UEFA, but they breached the rules already. The only thing is, after football leagues, UEFA thought that they should be punished harder than what they were in 2014. Hence the whole thing that we've seen now with the ban and then CAS and all of that. But they breached the rules before. Let's not forget that. It's just that they were lucky this time that the new ban and the CAS ruling happened more than 5 years later, so it was too late, and UEFA really couldn't have the real punishment that they wanted initially. So I think clubs will still have to follow FFP. I think PSG before City got away with it. I think City got away with it in a much bigger way than what they did, really. But for a lot of other clubs, it has worked. Before FFP, the money that big clubs in Europe were losing was huge. I think it was 1.8 billion. And I think in the last 2 years, they've actually, if you put all the big clubs together, they've actually made profit. So in a way, you can't say that it hasn't worked. But for sure, in some cases like PSG and City, they should have clearly been punished, I think, harder than what they have.
So why is it that some clubs like PSG and Man City can, as you say, get away with it, but others can't?
So for me, the wrong thing initially and technically will be those settlements that for PSG and Man City, those clubs were able to have with UEFA and with the body that rules basically financial fair play. I think if you breach it, you need to get banned and sanctioned. You can't just agree, okay, well, we pay a fine and then we only have 21 players in our Champions League squad next season and we do this and we do that. And I just think UEFA was far too lenient with PSG first and then with City once it was proven that those two clubs breached FFP before. I think they should have been far stronger in the punishment then because that was not, I think, a sanction that was in line with breaching financial fair play, if you see what I mean. After that, the Football League showed, well, at least alleged, that City lied and didn't really want to give other evidence and they were quite difficult to deal with, etc. And that's why UEFA then tried to punish them harder, which was not the case with PSG. And as we said, there was a loophole there, and well done for City for exploiting that loophole and the five-year thing. But I just think that in the first place, FFP was far too kind to PSG and City.
Can I just go back to Rafa and his bubble bath, please?
Please, yeah, join me.
Because you asked me whether I thought it'd get looser or tougher, FFP, on the back of this. What's your feeling?
It depends a little bit how the pendulum shifts. I mean, you're right to mention that in Italy, there is a feeling, I think, among some of the traditional powers that have been left behind, that financial fair play is more of a problem than a benefit to them. If you go to Spain, the big powers would say FFP is absolutely necessary because otherwise we will also be outspent by City and PSG. And I guess in Germany it's different yet again, because there even the smaller clubs absolutely support the idea of FFP, even though it doesn't really infringe on them that much. But they're worried that if FFP falls, they will not just be outspent by the PSGs and the Bayerns and the Juventus of this world, but also by Fulham, Southampton, Bournemouth and Burnley, and cannot keep any of their players. I think City have shown that the financial regulations are open to interpretation, and I think UEFA will have to think very hard and carefully next time they are bringing an investigation against the club. So I think it will have a chilling effect and make it much more difficult for them to be absolutely secure in their own verdict as far as the first body is concerned, which is not strictly speaking UEFA, but the commission, the adjudicatory chamber.
Well, your suds are running out, Rafa, so let's move on. Man City will be taking part in next season's Champions League and quite possibly the one after that. But what about this season's affair? Of course, the draw for that was held just last week, so let's get some thoughts on that next.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
All right then, how about that Champions League draw? Woof. All the big teams on one side of the draw and then a whole bunch of sides who have never won the competition in the other. Atalanta, PSG, RB Leipzig and Atletico Madrid, who are the only one of those four to have even reached the final before. Your Man City's, your Real Madrid's, Barcelona's, Juve's, Napoli, Bayern Munich's, they're all in the other side of this final eight, which is obviously a bit more than that at the moment because we've got some second legs of the last 16 matches to complete. What did you think of that lineup, Alvaro?
Well, I believe that there are great games coming up, obviously. I think that both sides of the draw have very similar levels, despite having, non-winners in one side of the draw. And many of them, they've got a really, really high level. I believe that Atletico de Madrid and PSG could win Champions League. And I wouldn't be too surprised, really, if they did it. I want to see how PSG is physically, after not having played a competitive game for many months. But generally speaking, I believe that this Champions League is so different with only one leg ties that everyone can win it, really. And it will be all down as well to how damaged the teams are getting there. I mean, the other day, Barcelona had only 7 players in the bench against Valladolid. Valladolid had 12 players in the bench. Barcelona just didn't have any more first team squad men there because they were all injured. So let's see how each team finishes the league, how Atalanta, Juventus make it. They are going to have one less week of rest in comparison to Spanish teams, and that's going to be very important too.
Right. Barcelona, of course, still have the second leg of their last 16 tie with Napoli. They had a 1-1 draw in Naples. I think the draw, that the element of the draw that has most people licking their lips, though, is the Atalanta-PSG matchup. Atalanta demonstrating on Saturday against Champions League opposition that they are very much ready to go deep in this competition. Paris Saint-Germain, as Alvaro mentions, with the slight disadvantage of not having league fixtures between now and then, they have got a couple of cup finals, and excitingly, this weekend, Jules, they had a friendly with Le Havre, which is in Normandy, I believe, yeah. and in front of fans and everything. How did that go?
Yeah, the 5,000 fans were there. I believe that's the first official game, if you want. The fans were allowed to go back in the stadium, Océane Stadium in Le Havre, and seemed to be quite smooth in the way the fans arrived and social distancing. If you didn't know, the people sat next to you or next to you on that row and things like that. So they were very happy the way it went with fans, and PSG were quite happy with the way the game went. They won 9-0. It was two different teams for each half. Thomas Tuchel changed everything at halftime. They were 5-0 up at halftime with the big team, if you want, Di Maria and Neymar and Mbappe and Icardi, who all were pretty good fitness-wise in that first 45 minutes. And then the second 45 minutes where they still scored 4 more goals. But they were, I think, very happy just to be back on the pitch and to play in that kind of environment. And they know, as Alvaro said, and we've said all along, that it's a disadvantage not to have had some league games to play between the restart and when the Champions League will resume. They will have those two cup finals, as you said, July 24th, July 31st. And then they can focus on that Atalanta game. I mean, James texted me straight after the draw, trolling me, saying, oh, Atalanta, blah, 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 already. And I can tell you, I'm scared. I watched the game on Saturday and I was like, oh my God, it's very much the same feeling that I had when they drew Dortmund in the last 16. And I think there's similarities between Dortmund and Atalanta in the way they attack, and maybe the way they lack experience as well, which I think maybe that's something PSG can exploit against Atalanta. But over one game, it's far more dangerous to play Atalanta than over two games against Dortmund. If you remember the first leg at Dortmund, PSG and Tuchel really messed it up, and they messed the formation and the tactic. And then they had the second leg to come back and win it. With Atalanta, you don't have that.
Yeah, surely the best thing for PSG though is to have one-legged, because your record in second legs is, well, we all know.
No, I know. Well, of course, you're right. But as we saw against Dortmund, it worked out well when in the first leg you mess up and you lose and you don't really have the right game plan or the right formation, and then in the second leg, especially in that case at the Parc des Princes, then you can turn it around. If Tuchel and the players get it wrong this time, or if they get it wrong for 75 minutes, that would be it. They would be out. So
that'd
it's
be very
tricky.
Sad.
It would be sad. Everybody would be cheering for Atalanta, especially you all. But I've got dinner.
No, no, don't talk for me.
Oh, thank you, Alvaro. I love you.
Seriously.
I sent Jules a text on Sunday, so I sent him the score 9-0, and he said, "Just watched it. they will do the same to Atalanta. So Jules predicting a 9-0.
Yeah, well, I do.
Of course, there's also Lyon in terms of Ligue 1 representatives who are currently 1-0 up against Juve from their first leg of a last 16 tie. What was the reaction in Germany to the draw for Bayern, Raf?
Yeah, the reaction was quite curious in Germany. I think there's been so much hype about Bayern winning the Champions League that the draw came as a bit of a reality check. It's like, oh, there are actually some pretty good teams left in this competition, and Bayern will have to play most of them if they want to get to the final or beyond. So perhaps not the worst thing in terms of the mental preparation of the club and the way that the fans and the media approach it. But of course, we often say that you need a bit of luck to win the Champions League. I think you'll probably need more luck than usual in this competition with one-legged games, etc. You can't make up for mistakes. And Bayern will have to do it the hard way, in most likelihood against Barcelona and then either City, Real Madrid or Juventus, no disrespect to Lyon. So it's a pretty tough route to the final where either PSG or Atletico are most likely to wait for them. So I don't think that the treble talk is quite as loud since Friday as it has been before in Munich.
And also there is another thing, James. There are some teams that make it to the Champions League quarterfinals, having won already their title. And I think that is going to ease off a little bit of the pressure. I don't know if for Bayern or for Juve, but for example, Barcelona gets there. And if they don't win Champions League, they will end up the season empty-handed. And same thing applies to Atletico de Madrid, probably to Atalanta and some other clubs. So I think that having won the title may play a part as well, because teams may be a little bit more calm and with the pressure off.
I think the pressure will still be on a team like Juventus, for example, who, of the three Italian teams in the Champions League, look the least likely to win it at this moment in time. Considering how they're playing, even though they somehow managed to extend their lead at the top of the table at the weekend, I think there was a feeling that they haven't convinced at all this season, and judgments will be made on the basis of what they do in the Champions League. So I think it's going to be very tough for them. In some respects, it's an advantage to come up against the Lyon side, which will have played one competitive game in that Coupe de la Ligue final. But they've still got a deficit to overcome. And even in Juventus's recent blowout wins against Genoa and Torino, those wins really had nothing to do with anything that Maurizio Sarri has done. They were down to moments of individual brilliance from Paulo Dybala and Cristiano Ronaldo. So in some respects, even a rusty Lyon, as long as they prove compact and hard to break down, they could frustrate Juventus. I think that's one of the curiosities for me, is that I think the pressure will still be very much on a team like Juventus going into that. And I imagine still on Tuchel as well, Jules, as well. Even though Leonardo's kind of come out and said he'll be our manager next season, this looks to me as the best possible side of the draw for PSG to be on, A, to reach a semi-final, which, correct me if I'm wrong, they haven't done since
they
the Qataris,
have.
But... Oh, they did.
Oh,
against,
not since the Qataris, sorry. Not
since the Qataris.
Over, yeah.
And overcome Atalanta, then you've got Atleti or Leipzig. PSG should reach the final. I'm sorry, Jules. They should reach the final.
No, I think you're right. I think it's a good draw in that sense. You're right. It's a very tricky draw. And I've seen loads of PSG fans, and I got loads of texts and people saying, oh, this is great. And in fairness, for ESPN, I had to give my dream draw, and it was very similar to that. I had Leipzig in the quarters and then the winner of Atalanta Atletico in the semis.
Jules' magic balls.
I know, you know, the hot balls. It's still a tricky draw, and I think a lot of PSG fans, despite everything that we've been saying on Atalanta and underestimate, I think, that team. We will see what happens, and the pressure on Tuchel is huge. But just quickly on Lyon, where, having seen you were losing to Milan, for example, and conceding those four goals in half an hour, and then that game against Atalanta where they should have never even got a point, I think they were, in a way, a bit confident, or at least reassured that, okay, it's just not impossible to be able to keep the advantage from the first leg. The day before the draw, Jean-Michel Aulas went on radio on RMC and had this wonderful sentence where he said, we've never had so many chances of winning the Champions League. He also said they could lose of losing it as well. And then the next day is the draw, and it's the draw of hell for them. So well done, President, for jinxing your team. But you know, this is true a bit from what we've been saying. Because it's on one game, anything is possible. Although for Lyon, it would be really a miracle for them to go all the way to the final.
Well, it is a fascinating format. There'll be ample time, of course, for us to preview all those fixtures, starting with the last 16 second legs, before the competition gets back underway. Of course, there was also the Europa League draw, the quarterfinals of that competition. And we'll be getting onto that a little bit later on. But next up, let's have some of the weekend's action.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on the Athletic app, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Contro Cuadrado, dalla posizione di alla sinistra, va ancora da Marinowski, 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 destro! Il raddoppio della Dea al 35esimo minuto!
How about a bit of Serie A? Some big games since we last spoke, two whole rounds of action indeed, since our last European show. The big game, we've touched on it already, was Saturday in Turin, and a 2-2 draw between Juventus and the big story of the Serie A season, Atalanta. They shared the points, but the headlines were all for Atalanta, particularly for one spell in the game, which they absolutely played La Signora off the park. 8 minutes and 11 seconds in which Juve did not manage to touch the ball in their opponent's half. And this is at home. This is the eight-time consecutive champions of Italy. It was magnificent stuff, James.
Yeah, and the team doing it is paid only, what, 5 or 6 million more than Juventus pay Cristiano Ronaldo. I think we should never lose sight of that. And I think it's embarrassing, not only for Juventus, but for a lot of the other big clubs with bigger wage bills and bigger budgets to see a team like Atalanta go to Turin and be so dominant and impose themselves on Juventus. And yeah, again, this is one of the reasons why Juventus appointed Maurizio Sarri, was to do that to teams and not let it be done unto them. And they were unlucky. You know, ultimately, this ridiculous interpretation of the handball rule has cost them another prestigious win. And you mentioned the headlines for Atalanta and the Italian media on Sunday morning, James. I mean, I think the first paragraph in La Repubblica really summed it up. You know, that the stat of the day is Juventus stopped Atalanta, not vice versa. A team of champions managed to get through the night against the best team in the league, which is Atalanta. And they haven't been the best team overnight. They've been certainly the best team since the restart, where they've only dropped 2 points. They're on, I think, an 11-game winning streak across all competitions as well. And I think you have to look at how some of the other teams that were challenging for the title, like Lazio, like Inter, have fallen away on the basis that this compressed schedule, they don't have the squads to compete. It makes no difference to Atalanta because they can bring on Malinowski, they can bring on Muriel. I think this team has recruited so well when they've got richer, either through selling some of the players that Gasperini brought through or from competing in the Europa League and in the Champions League. When they have spent in excess of 13 million on Deroon, on Zapata, on Muriel, on Malinowski, they've got it absolutely right.
Juve coming back into this game, both times that Atalanta took the lead, thanks to penalties for handball. You mentioned the kind of building furore over interpretation of the handball rule in Italy, which I think is far more severe than anywhere else in Europe. Certainly the numbers of penalties being given is far higher than in other leagues and far higher than it's ever been in Serie A as well.
All the handballs pretty much are given as penalties. There was a few reaction after the game, I thought, on social media, especially of people saying, oh, this is like Calciopoli, this is Juve always gets those kind of decisions. Well, De Ligt did 4 handballs and got done every time. Bonucci the other day against Milan, when they were totally in control, that handball was given against Juve. That penalty started the comeback from... So Juve also were on the back on that night on Saturday. It was in their favour. But before, many times already this season, it cost them penalties as well. So it's not just like, yeah, you know...
They've had 10 penalties given them against them this season.
Yeah.
10. Right.
Juve dropping points in that match. But they still, as you mentioned, extended their lead because Lazio lost their third straight game, 2-1 at home to the remarkable Sassuolo, who are now on 4 straight wins. Nero Verdi.
Siamo forti.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they've got a chance of qualifying for the Europa League as well. I think that's one of the reasons why Roma's win against Brescia on Saturday night was important because it kept Sassuolo at arm's length. But they've been magnificent since the restart. I think one of the things that goes into that was, remember Emilia-Romagna, which is the region where Sassuolo are based. They kind of lifted some of the restrictions on teams going back to training earlier than some of the other regions did. So Sassuolo, I think, were the first team back in training after lockdown, and you can really see it. But yeah, Roberto Di Zerbi, their coach, has long been kind of regarded as one of the up-and-coming managers in the league, the next big thing. And his style of football is certainly one admirer, not only in Italy but outside of Italy. Pep Guardiola is a big fan of Di Zerbi and his whole approach. And just as Atalanta have got, what, three players have scored 15 or more goals? Sassuolo have got three players in double figures as well, Boga, Caputo, Berardi. And their only defeat, I think, since the restart was the first game that they had back against Atalanta. And they were really unlucky in that game. I think if you look at the XG numbers, they're pretty much parity. They deserve three goals from the chances that they got. They play Juventus next. So title race clearly isn't over, James.
Wow. Well, six rounds to go. Surely isn't. A couple of other things we should touch on. One is another big game on Sunday night where Milan, who've been in incredible form of late, they beat Roma, they beat Lazio, and of course they had that 4-2 come-from-behind win against Juve in the middle of last week. They went to Napoli, San Paolo, on Sunday night, another team in good form, and it ended a 2-2 draw. Interesting game, this one, against Gennaro Gattuso, of course, the growler, the Milan legend. But yet more evidence of the fantastic job that Stefano Pioli's been doing at the club, despite the fact that they are going to be ditching him at the end of the season. A listener's writing in about the proposed or the imminent change, Pioli for Ralf Rangnick. Graham says, are Milan making a massive mistake given that Pioli's got the team playing so well? George B. Livingston asks, what can we expect a Rangnick Milan to look like? Rafa.
Well, time will tell if they make a mistake or not. I mean, I have to tell you that sources close to Rangnick last week were saying this is not a done deal yet.
I had that confirmed today as well.
That it's not done yet.
So they might stay with Pioli?
I think it's a conversation that they're still open to having. You know, contrary to what Sky Italia and Gazzetta reported last week, I think if you read that Gazzetta report, a lot of it is conditional. It's not this is happening despite the headline, and you know I've been told that it's still up in the air. You know, obviously there has been contact, there have been talks with Ralf Rangnick, but you know they are aware of the good job that Stefano Pioli is doing right now. And look, if you look at what's happened in the Red Bull Sporting Network, you know Ralf Rangnick has worked above Julian Nagelsmann. He's worked above a coach. Now, whether that would happen is something that would be acceptable to not only Stefano Pioli, but you know also technical director at the time at the moment, Paolo Maldini, I think still remains to be seen. But I would caution against saying this is already done and that Ralf Rangnick will be Milan's coach next season, because I think there's no ink on paper at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, to answer the second question, I think the attraction really is to get one guy that can turn a football club around and build structures to last, because you're always going to have successful managers, less successful managers, but I think what he has shown at Hoffenheim and even more so at Leipzig is that he can put structures in place when it comes to the scouting, the quality of players that you attract, but also the quality of coaches that you attract, that leaves a lasting mark. And I think that's what Milan want. I don't think they want necessarily, you know, just a short-term solution, a coach that might work or might not work for a couple of years. I think this is a much sort of more deeper, more vertically integrated project, I think, that they're looking at. And Rangnick, because of his track record, I think suggests that he can do that kind of job. And I think that's why it is very attractive to go for him. But at the same time, of course, with all these different parts of the jobs and different hats that he's supposed to wear, I think you're entering into lots of different discussions where it's far more convoluted a discussion rather than just hiring a new manager. So the attraction is at the same time, I think, the complication, because you have to clearly define where the competences start and where they end. And he needs to agree that he can work under the conditions that, that Milan put forward.
All right. One or two other things from the weekend. Huge game down at the bottom end of the table. A struggling Spal lost to Genoa with a wonderful free kick for the Grifoni from Alassa Scherny. And then the second goal from Goran Pandev. Goran Pandev, 37 years of age. Extraordinary that he's... I mean, every time that he scores or he features, I have to just check. Is this the? Is it his son, who's also called Goran Pandev? He was playing for Inter in 2001. His teammates were the likes of Toldo, Ronaldo the Phenomenal, Recoba, Vieri and Adriano. He's literally a living link to a bygone age. It's fabulous that he's still out there.
Yeah, no, I mean... One of the crazy things about Genoa is he's been there for quite some time now, and this is a club that has gone through 119 different players in the last 3 or 4 years, which is just remarkable. I think it's one of the reasons why that club continues to find itself fighting relegation. There's no stability. It's one of the reasons why you look at two of the best managers in the league at the moment, James Gasperini and Ivan Juric, both of whom have been Genoa coaches. And Gasperini did a very good job, and I think would have been able to get similar results to what he's been getting at Atalanta had there been stability there. But Juric got sacked once, twice, three times, looked a broken man after it, and is now coaching Hellas Verona to a kind of revelatory season. But Pandev's still going. His hair has thinned, and I believe there's a image on social media, what was it, last season, of his hair looking a little bit reminiscent of a cock and balls at that time. But he's got competition for places up front as there, because they've bought like 7 or 8 strikers, none of which, apart from Pandev and Pinamonti, who Jules is a big fan of, can actually score any goals. So yeah, good to see the Pandev, sort of aging like a fine pesto. Does pesto age in general? I mean,
not
I imagine
particularly.
You'd
get, I
wouldn't think so. Yeah,
right. It's a conservation Pandev project, perhaps. save the Pandev. Maybe something along those lines. Well, it's been emotional. After this, let's move on to La Liga.
Después del taconazo de la intervención de Leo, de Diego, Luis Suárez, Barça 1, Español 0.
Álvaro, since we last spoke in Spain, Barcelona won the derby, sending Espanyol down. Would that be especially sweet for them as a derby win, or would there be some sort of Catalan camaraderie there?
There is no camaraderie, but there is no sweetness either, because Barcelona played really badly. It was obvious that at some point Espanyol was going to go down, and fortunately for Espanyol that didn't happen in front of supporters, because maybe some derogatory chants would have been heard from Barcelona fans to Espanyol fans. But the thing there, and I would say that the important thing is that number one, Espanyol has been relegated after more than 25 years in the top flight. From 1995 onwards, only Athletic de Bilbao, Valencia, Real Madrid, Barcelona and Espanyol had played all the seasons in the top flight. Even Atletico and Sevilla have been down. And they are going to find it very difficult to negotiate with the second division, because they've got a high budget. They will have to offload a few players. Let's see who buys them in these conditions and in this financial landscape. And as I said, there is only 1 month for the reconstruction of Espanyol, and that's going to be difficult for them, definitely. And I don't know how they will navigate a division that they don't know too well, because they've been out of it for the quarter of a century. And then when it comes to Barcelona, well, the title race is still alive after Barcelona beat 1-0 Espanyol, 1-0 to Valladolid away. Real Madrid can win La Liga on Thursday. They just have to do the job against Granada. They have to play against them. And then if they beat Villarreal after beating Granada, they will be La Liga champions for the first time since 2017.
Brilliant. Then they can put their feet up, because some of them, Gareth Bale, for example, looks exhausted.
Yes. You said something about Jules before, that he had a good tan. I think that Gareth Bale has also a very good tan, because he was pretty much sunbathing, or looking like he was sunbathing in Real Madrid bench the other day. Well, that is a testament to what Gareth Bale means for Zinedine Zidane, and maybe what Zidane means for Gareth Bale at this stage of both their careers. To be honest with you, Real Madrid doesn't think, and Zidane doesn't think, that Gareth Bale is a very useful tool at this stage of the season for Real Madrid, and he's barely playing in the same way that James Rodriguez, which is a totally different case, is just gone from Real Madrid. He doesn't play anymore.
That famous picture of him wearing his face mask over his eyes as if it was a sleep mask during Real Madrid's 2-1 win over Alaves. What kind of reaction did that get in Spain?
Well, the reaction was like, this is one more from Gareth Bale. I mean, I think that nothing compares the reaction of that message he saw with his teammates of Wales, saying golf, Wales and Real Madrid in that order. Nothing compares that, but yeah, the reaction has been a little bit like, this is another one from Gareth Bale. To be honest with you, this season started leaking plenty of things that Gareth Bale has been doing over the last years, just because I think that the Real Madrid propaganda channels, they have allowed it. For example, at Real Madrid, the players in the home games, they are allowed to, the players who are not in the match day squad, but they are at Santiago Bernabeu in the home games, they are allowed to leave the pitch in the 80th minute, just not to find any traffic when the game is over, so they can run away with the car from the ground as quick as they can. Well, Gareth Bale has been doing it for the most of the season, every time he hasn't been in the match day squad. Whereas some other players, when they are not in the match day squad, they stay, they go to the locker room after the game, they cheer their teammates if they have lost. Well, Gareth Bale doesn't do that, you know. There are few things that are happening there that tell you that he is totally detached from the team, and obviously some other seasons Real Madrid has tried to disguise all that, saying that Gareth Bale is playing really well when he plays, that he's still an important asset of the team, but this season I think that not even that is happening. Those journalists who were writing favorable reports about him don't do that anymore, and I think that the relationship of Gareth Bale with Zidane, as I said before, is pretty much gone. And same thing applies for James Rodriguez. Again, he was not in the squad, and the James Rodriguez thing is even worse, because at least Gareth Bale has scored some of the most iconic goals of Real Madrid in the last 5 years, but James Rodriguez hasn't been that player, and Real Madrid paid for him 80 million in the summer of 2014, and he's on his way out as well. So they have to find a team that pays some money for James Rodriguez, and obviously they are not going to get back all the investment they did 6 years ago for this player.
Situation anyway in La Liga, with not long to go, the final round of the season is next weekend, is that Barcelona are just 1 point behind Real Madrid, although Real Madrid have yet to play their game from this round. Barcelona, in the meantime, with some bad news that during the 1-0 win over Real Valladolid, they managed to lose Antoine Griezmann for the rest of the season, or the end of this week, whichever you prefer.
Yeah, and the question is whether he will be fit for the Champions League. Probably yes. I mean, he's got a muscle injury in the quadriceps of his right leg, and he won't be playing for the remainder of the season. He has scored 9 goals in the league, and the stats will stay that way. Probably not enough for what was expected from Antoine Griezmann. And this is another injury in a season that Barcelona has suffered, a lot of them. I mean, at the beginning of the season, Messi was not ready to play. Suarez got a very important injury. Dembélé, a player that we shouldn't forget about, is not there yet, and he won't be fit to play the Champions League. Frenkie de Jong is out now. And they will try to regroup players together as soon as they can for the Champions League. And if Antoine Griezmann and Frenkie de Jong can be fit for the Champions League, that would be fantastic.
Alvaro, if they miss Griezmann, who scored the away goal in Naples, they're also going to be missing Sergio Busquets and Arturo Vidal, who are suspended. Napoli have proven themselves to be a very good team in cup games this season. They've pretty much been able to beat Lazio, Inter, Juve, and they performed very well in that Barcelona game. Barcelona,
what are you
concerned?
Saying? Are you saying that Napoli are going to knock out Barcelona? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm willing to stake I'm not going to stake another dinner on that because you owe me that. But but you know, I'm saying that things slightly falling into place for Napoli ahead of their tie at the Camp Nou. Although Barca haven't lost there since what Bayern went and absolutely destroyed them when Bayern won the treble
in 2013. Yeah, that's true. And to be honest with you, I think that Barcelona is going to suffer a lot from not having Sergio Busquets, especially because Arturo Vidal has a very clear replacement, which is Frenkie de Jong in there, or even Sergi Roberto could play as a midfielder because he's a very useful squad player. But Sergio Busquets not being there, there is no a clear replacement for the very veteran player, and probably a midfielder of Rakitic, Ricky and Frenkie de Jong is not qualified, perhaps, in Champions League at least, to play against a team of that caliber. I don't know if that midfield is actually experienced enough. I don't think so. But still, I mean, at Camp Nou, normally Barcelona is a favourite against anybody.
Okay, well, final round, as we say, this weekend, Real Madrid with a one-point lead. Top four all but sorted. Then Barcelona, Atletico Madrid and Sevilla. And then a bunch of teams battling over the Europa League spots, including Villarreal are in great form and picked up a whopping 3-1 win over their rivals Getafe Wednesday night, after which they had a right old set to, Alvaro, with the police getting involved.
Yes, all that happened, and the police went there after the game, and a few Getafe players were really annoyed and fighting in the dugout, and finally some Getafe players got like red cards, and yes, this is a bad thing for a team that has a short squad, and the likes of Echeita, for example, a very important defender, will be out, and also Niom and Gené, I believe. So yes, that was quite a controversial one.
Okay, well, we get the final verdict on La Liga in next week's show. A couple of things before we hear from the extraordinary Luis Miguel Echegaray on the pretty extraordinary situation right now with MLS. Porto could be crowned champions of Portugal on either Tuesday or Wednesday of this week. They're currently 8 points clear of Benfica, 3 matches to go. And also, of course, the Europa League draw. We'll touch on that next. Rafa, Europa League is coming to Germany.
Yeah, it's coming to Germany, but as Thomas Helmer told UEFA, it's the Cup of Losers, which went really
that was
down, which went down
that
really well.
Brilliant.
Why would he say such a thing?
I don't know.
He was making the draw, you know, and as he was making the draw, it was brilliant.
The Cup of Losers. Remarkable.
What does that make the conference, which is going to come into effect next season?
Yeah. Well, this year's losers include Wolves, and Olympiacos. The winner of their tie, they're currently at 1-1, will be facing Sevilla or Roma. Man United are in there. They're 5-0 up against the team from Linz, Lask. Basaksehir or Copenhagen will be their adversaries in the quarterfinals. Inter Milan, if they get past Getafe, will be taking on either Bayer Leverkusen or Rangers. And the other quarterfinal will see either Wolfsburg or Shakhtar taking on either Eintracht Frankfurt and Basel, although Basel have a 3-0 lead from the first leg. But anyway, Rafa, for the three Bundesliga sides involved in the competition, huge home advantage here.
I mean, Leverkusen, perhaps, because they are based very close to some of the stadiums being used. But for Frankfurt and Wolfsburg, it's not much of a home advantage to have to travel just like everybody else. And of course, no fans being there. In the Bundesliga, it got to the point where home advantage was seen as a home disadvantage, because the teams away from home, nominally, tended to get much better results. So a minor, I think, positive effect of the draw, but not that much.
It's worth noting again that the Sevilla-Roma and Inter Milan-Getafe's game will be played over on one game. They could not play the first leg, so they're the two games that would just be played not home and away like all the others, but just over one game in Germany, you know, at the beginning of August.
Which is great because you've got the Monchi derby. No bad blood between Monchi and Roma after what went down there. And you have an Inter side coached by a manager who is deeply unhappy. Antonio Conte. This was one of the big stories of the week in Italy of Conte basically saying, well, I think we're going to have to review things at the end of the season, aren't we? not going my way, I don't think. And then there was the water break during Inter's game against Verona, in which he just stayed away from his players because just couldn't bear to look at them. you know, ultimately, this is Conte has always won a trophy in his first season wherever he's been, apart from Atalanta, where he got sacked after a few weeks. So this is their last chance to win a trophy. But and also, I think the other wrinkle to add in here is, you know, particularly with Chris Smalling playing for Roma, Alexis Sanchez playing for Inter, you know, both of those players are on loan from Manchester United, who are in the Europa League, and
could potentially meet Inter in the final as well.
Yes,
they're not allowed to play in the Europa League right now, right? Is that true? They can finish La Serie A, but they're not allowed. Yeah.
So that was the point I was about to make: is that United, as of today, have yet to grant an extension for the loans of Sanchez and Smalling beyond the end of the domestic season in Serie A. Sanchez can play in the Getafe game. I think Smalling can play in the Sevilla game, but Roma's still kind of negotiating to see whether they can get Smalling cleared for the rest of the Europa League. Inter certainly not particularly happy with the rule, the loophole in the rules, which United are perfectly in their rights to apply. That basically means it's up to them whether they allow Alexis to play or not.
We're all rooting for that Inter Man United final, though, to see Man United's old goal scoring talisman Lukaku against
it's young,
the new
imagine. In for Lukaku, who lays it off for Sanchez. Goal!
89th minute, 1-0 win.
Yeah, there you go.
Good. Well, that's the Europa League, and it's coming up. Those fixtures kind of meshed in with the Champions League one, so it's going to be a fascinating fortnight, really, of European competition in August. We're going to finish off today with a bit of a journey across the Atlantic. MLS is back, sort of, a bit. You will recall that they started their season in February, had to suspend it in March. So they've decided that the best thing is to come back with a one-off tournament held in the number one virus hotspot pretty much of the entire world, Florida. A solution so bad, not even the French contemplated it. To find out why they've done this and how it's all going, let's welcome back to the Totally Football Show, Luis Miguel Echegaray of Sports Illustrated. Hi, Luis.
Jimbo, good to hear your voice again. Hope everybody's safe over there in the UK.
Yes, hope you're safe over there. First of all, why? Why the MLS is back tournament, Luis?
Oh, Jimbo, how long do you have? This, unfortunately, is somewhat of a complex issue that really is riddled with, mixed emotions. You know, as many, you know, in any other sport, specifically in the U.S., when you think about the NBA, NHL, MLB, NWSL, etc., every sports fan wants action to return. They're eager about it, especially during a time like this when people are just looking for normalcy. MLS is no different. So, you know, when all of this began, the MLS is back tournament, it really was, a chance for Don Garber and his league to try and bring back some kind of that normalcy that I just talked about. Obviously, they're not the first sports-based team league that came back in the U.S. That was the NWSL. But MLS was the first male sports team-based league in the U.S. to come back, and it did it, you know, in certain issues of a bubble in Orlando. Now, there's a lot to talk about within this specific situation because, for one, we have to remember the backdrop of all this. This is in Orlando, in Florida, where it's a state that is really not taking care of business when it comes to the pandemic. Just yesterday, state officials announced that the state had a record-setting 15,300 new virus cases, the most ever announced in a single day by any U.S. state. And the Orlando area in itself had just under 44,000 total cases and 426 deaths. The reason I have to bring these numbers is because it's very important to remember that this is a tournament being held in a country that is still not taking full grips of the pandemic. Ron DeSantis has refused to order the state citizens to wear masks, etc. So within all of this, you have MLS coming into the bubble at Disney Resorts, where the NBA will also be coming as well. It's already here, actually. So, you know, you have all these issues, all these storylines that all brings down to one thing. what is going on in terms of the safety. SC Dallas has already pulled out. Nashville already pulled out. So, you know, DC United against Toronto, which was meant to happen on Sunday, had to happen this morning because of a player testing positive and another one, an inconclusive test. So you have this sort of mountain of issues coming every time. Now, I talked to Nani, you know, the former Manchester United, the Portugal star who plays for Orlando City, and he you know, they all feel safe. They feel like MLS is doing a very good job in terms of the intricacies of what a player and a team needs to do while they're at the resort. The problem is that this is all down to behavior, human behavior, and you can't control what's going to happen once you are inside a bubble. And that's basically what's happening. Every day you're hearing a new test being positive from a player or a team. And so the inconsistency lies within that you just can't predict what's going to happen.
Right. One of the issues as well, Luis, is that the bubble is a pretty porous one, given that there was no quarantine for the players before they went to Orlando, whereas in Bundesliga and I think Premier League as well, players were isolating with their families perhaps, but staying clear of too much social contact before then joining up with their teammates. The MLS clubs have arrived in Orlando to enter the bubble without even a day's quarantine. So you're getting people bringing in all these positives. You mentioned Nashville and FC Dallas withdrawing, and both times it was because the teams had had multiple positives for COVID-19.
Yep, a really good point. Right, exactly. In the lead up to the tournament, you know, players were not quarantining, or at least taking a test that had a lengthy period of time that was able to prove to them that they were ready to go to the bubble. And, you know, it's funny that we talk about the bubble. And a bubble is very delicate. And that's exactly what's proven to be in this case. Now, listen, the thing is, the other part of it is that you have to also remember that even without a COVID situation, you know, if something major or serious happens to a player during a game and they have to go to hospital, what happens to these local hospitals that are already filled up with coronavirus cases that may not have, you know, and a player that may not well be dealing with a COVID-19, but rather an injury, where do you fit them in? That's exactly what happened in the first game, actually. A player from Inter Miami, Reyes, had to, you know, he was elbowed in the neck by Don Duarte, the Orlando City forward. It was a very scary moment. You know, they had to pause the game. He had trouble breathing, so they had to take him to the hospital. Now, luckily, he's okay. According to reports, he's fine now. But still, what happens to players in a game situation and they need to go to a local hospital? And, you know, these hospitals in Florida are completely overwhelmed. So that's another issue as well. The other one, actually, the last part, is that, you know, MLS and NBA are using the same company for testing, which is an excessive, aggressive testing schedule, right? I think it's almost every other day. But, you know, there's been already reports of things like these kinds of companies are prioritizing these kinds of situations as opposed to a regular citizen. Why does it take a day and a half for a professional athlete to get a test back as opposed to like a week for a regular citizen? So there's so many issues with this, but, you know, MLS still continues.
Well, so far we've had, well, two teams withdraw, three games played, one postponed. We have had the first Florida derby in there, Orlando beating Inter Miami 2-1, and Jaap Stam getting off to a losing start with his new side, Cincinnati. Is the feeling now that things have got rolling that they should be all right, or is there a real danger that things are going to unravel further and maybe this MLS tournament isn't actually going to complete?
It's a good question, and your guess is as good as mine. I think that, you know, obviously there are the words that you take from the commissioner, Don Garber, who says, you know, the moment we feel that it's completely, you know, dangerous and a risk for athletes, then we will stop the tournament. But I don't know what that limit is. I don't know what that means. We've already had two teams pull out completely. I don't know if that means that another Nashville-Dallas situation might pull that out, because once you have that, then you have to rearrange the groups once again. Because let's not forget, this is also about, you know, obviously less important, but, you know, the wins or losses or ties within the group stage is also a matter for the regular season whenever that returns. And there's a $1.1 million prize money and a 2021 CONCACAF Champions League berth spot to be talked about. So there's also the other side of it that's still at stake. It may not be huge stakes, but it's still something. So I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if another team pulls out, maybe. But you know, so far we still have, as you mentioned, games being played. Today we have both LA teams playing today: LAFC, Houston Dynamo, LA Galaxy against Portland. So you know, we'll see what happens.
All right. So finally, Luis, the results in this tournament act as a part of the regular season that was suspended back in March. They're incorporated into the rest of the fixtures then when that finally gets back underway.
Correct. Yeah. So the games within the group stages, they all matter for points within the regular season. And then this, as I mentioned, there's a $1.1 million prize money, plus the winner gets a 2021 CONCACAF Champions League berth spot.
Right. And Dallas and Nashville have a bunch of fixtures to make up once the season does get underway, because they didn't play any in the MLS's back tournament.
Exactly. And the other thing to remember as well, by the way, is that, you know, from a marketing perspective, Carlos Vela is not playing. Defender of the Year from last year, Ike Opara, is not playing. You know, so there are also stars that are missing from the tournament. How much that affects the league is still yet to be answered. But, you know, it's a major thing, especially with somebody like Carlos Vela, who, you know, last season's MVP.
All right, well, fingers crossed. And let's hope, Luis, that soon we'll be talking about some amazing football out on the field. And that nobody's bubble bursts. Many thanks for speaking to us today, and best of luck in the meantime.
Thank you, Jimbo. Thanks, everybody.
Well, there you go. Extraordinary stuff over in Orlando. That brings us to the end of today's Totally Football Show, European edition. Alvaro, James, Jules, Rafa, anything you want to leave us with?
Yeah, I would like to say something, James. There is a newly promoted team to La Liga. It's
Cadiz.
Called Cadiz, and I don't know if we talk about it, but they signed Álvaro Negredo. They announced it last night after they got promoted. So he will be another very young striker in La Liga meet with the likes of Benzema, Messi, Raúl García, Luis Suárez, and the ones that are top in the scoring charts in there, in our La Liga competition.
Lovely. What a nice town Cadiz is. James?
Yes, I've never been, but it's going to go on the bucket list, James. I had one quick thing to add, which is Parma, their bubble has been burst, James, in that they had a positive test at the weekend. A member of their medical staff, he was isolated immediately, and the players were tested, and they got the results 4 hours before the Bologna game. They were all negative, and so they were able to play that game. But they will spend the next 14 days in quarantine at the training ground in Colecchio outside Parma. So they're still able to keep playing as long as you know, they're healthy and they keep passing positive tests. The other thing that I had was a question for Jules, which I think was probably going to be a question that Rafa might ask, which is Bayern have signed a young French defensive prospect, Kouassi, from Paris Saint-Germain. I just wondered what Jules's take on him is.
He wants to be called Nianzu now.
Yeah, which is his other surname. Yeah, we talked about it before when he signed. He was a huge blow for PSG to lose him. He refused to sign his first professional deal. He joined the club when he was 12. And he played a lot this season with Thomas Tuchel, and I think he was a big blow. They really thought he would sign. He decided to go to Bayern Munich, where he felt he was better for, you know, for his pathway towards being a regular in a very strong team and winning loads of trophies, which I can also understand.
There's a is point. Is he Paris born and bred, though, Jules?
He is Paris born and bred.
And he's rejected pro contract.
I can
Paris.
Understand why some players before, like Kingsley Coman or Moussa Dembélé or Boubacary Soumaré and Zagadou and all those players who left very young, either very early in their professional career or before signing their first professional deal with PSG, and why they left. But Kouassi cannot tell me that he didn't think he would play, because he played a lot already this season for a 17-year-old. He only turned 18 in July, and he would have played even more next season with Thiago Silva not having his contract renewed, for example. So the argument of, oh, I left because I would not have played, in this case, it doesn't work. So tell me that you left because you would earn more money at Bayern, which is the case, and his agent took a much bigger commission than if they stayed in Paris. I get that, and I don't want to criticize that. That's a fair point. But don't give it to me but I'm going to play more at Bayern next season than I would have played in PSG, because that's not the case.
Can I just add, for all the listeners who'd be disappointed that there was no Bundesliga section today, of course the league is already finished, that there is a piece on The Athletic about the problems of the Bundesliga when it comes to competitiveness and possible ways to address that imbalance that we have seen in recent years. So go and check that out.
Send it to Javier Tebas as well, Rafael.
Yeah, but at least you have two or three teams. We only have one at the moment.
All right, well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Many thanks to Alvaro, Rafa, Jules and James, and you, listener, and producer Charlie. We'll be back soon. Do hope you'll be with us. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Keep up to date with everything across our Totally Football network at The Totally Show on Twitter. And make sure you check out our brand new website too, thetotallyfootballshow.com.
Muddy Knees Media.